Hello, and welcome to this MomsFightingAutism.com webinar. I'm your host for this evening, Chantal Cecile Kira, author of various books on autism, including Autism Life Skills, Adolescence on the Autism Spectrum, and Autism Spectrum Disorders. Today, in honor of National Autism Awareness Month, which is what April is here in the United States, where I'm calling you and speaking to you from, we are proud to have as our guest Jonathan Alderson, and I've specifically picked Jonathan for tonight's show because it is Autism Awareness Month and because he has started a multi-treatment intervention approach. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about Jonathan now, and then he will speak to you about his multi-treatment program. Jonathan Alderson is an autism treatment specialist working in private practice in Toronto. He specializes in merging educational and biomedical treatments through an integrated model he has developed called Intensive Multi-Treatment Intervention. Alderson holds a master's degree in education from Harvard University and completed an honors BA in developmental and educational psychology at the University of Western Ontario. He spent a year at the Sorbonne in Paris. Alderson worked for 8 years at the Sunrise Program in Massachusetts, completing over 1,500 hours of one-on-one floor time, as well as acting as administrator and directing staff training. He has worked with over 2,000 families, supervising home-based interventions in the United Kingdom, Ireland, Holland, Spain, Australia, Israel, and Mexico. Alderson has spoken at several international venues, including the Royal College of Pediatricians at the University of Nottingham, and he is a guest speaker for the Canadian Psychiatric Research Foundation. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good evening.
How about, to start off, could you please tell us a bit about your multi-treatment intervention and how you came about to develop this program?
Definitely. I think a place to begin would be kind of a background of my own journey through autism, which seems to parallel many of the families that I work with, one that is basically a bit scattered, somewhat overwhelming, and disjointed in terms of finding a path, a navigation through this maze of autism treatments. There's hundreds and hundreds of treatments available out there. As I mentioned in the article that was posted from the Autism File, the last time I Googled autism, I got 20 million hits.
Right.
So just thinking about how trying to answer the question, how does a parent decide what to do for their child and how to pick? So over many years of going to conferences, reading books, having training in different programs, I began to feel that the field of autism was sort of like a chain of islands, if you will, a little metaphor. And there I was in my canoe, maybe many parents around me in canoes as well, traveling over to maybe the ABA or the IBI, the behavioral island, getting out, learning what's there, maybe taking some information, but then hearing, hey, over on this other island is a special diet or biomedical treatment. So they hop in their canoe, paddle over to the next island, learn what's over there, and while they're learning some dietary things, they hear about this other island. Maybe it's called occupational therapy or music therapy or horse riding therapy. And soon enough, a parent has learned many different approaches, but each island almost feels separate. And the question I had for myself as I had this kind of experience was, how do these fit together? This question was also pertinent to me in my work with families because I saw how many parents were kind of put in the position of having to play that role of program administrator, of having to figure it out, of having to sometimes play the advocate or sometimes the devil's advocate between different professionals and school boards and things like that. And what I wanted to do was to create a program where I could take that role instead of the parent and merging the various pieces of a program together and piecing it together. So that's sort of how I came about doing what I do.
Interesting. I really like the analogy that you have there of the different islands. It certainly does feel that way when you're a parent.
If I can just share, maybe as a context, I know that so many families have sent in questions, and I'm really eager to get to those and do what I can to answer some of them. But maybe as a context for our time together, I would like to share a few principles of a multi-treatment program that might give the listeners an idea of some of the framework, if you will, through which I might answer the questions.
Okay.
So I just have a couple here. The first sort of principle that I work by when trying to choose a treatment program for a child and pull pieces together is just starting with the idea that the diagnosis of autism is multifaceted. It's multifactorial. There's a language component. There's a social component, behavioral component. We believe there's a biomedical component. And when we look out to the question of, well, what is causing autism, without going down that discussion this evening, many people would agree that it's likely multifactorial as well. And so the principle I want to lay out first is that I think that treatment should be multifaceted and multifactorial. So if you're a parent listening with a child with autism and you're pursuing just one modality, maybe you're just pursuing behavioral intervention, or you're only pursuing a biomedical intervention, I'd encourage you to think about a multi-treatment approach. So that'd be number one. Number two would be the idea that learning and acquiring skills, whether it's cognitive or behavioral, is a biological process. And so the physical health of your child with autism really needs to be a priority before behavioral training and before education. And my sort of anecdote here would be, I remember working in a program in the United States where we were at early phases of an intervention program, and we were doing play therapy, and the child was simply not responding to this play therapy, no matter how sort of playful and animated and energized we were working with this child. But what we did notice is that the child seemed to have quite a bloated stomach. The child seemed definitely had ongoing bowel issues, and just seemed to not feel well a lot of the time. And so we took a course of helping that child to feel better in his body through some diet interventions and so on and so forth, working in conjunction with the medical doctor. And what we found fairly rapidly, actually, within sort of 3 to 4 months, was that when we then did the play therapy sessions, the child was so much more responsive. And so here's an example where there's sort of almost steps to doing what we did, and we probably could have saved ourselves time and money and resources had we not begun the play therapy before the child is in some ways ready to be open to that. So the idea of addressing health concerns maybe before we launch really deeply into other programs, that'd be principle number two. Principle number three I might suggest for our listeners to consider is that each individual treatment, each strategy you might learn from a speech and language pathologist or from your occupational therapist or your music instructor should really be chosen and brought into a multi-treatment program based on the indications, the preconditions that you would want to use it for. For example, you probably wouldn't start a special diet unless you had reason to believe that your child needed that, for example. Also based, these treatments should be chosen based on contraindications, meaning there might be situations where you wouldn't want to do music therapy with a child. And then thinking about the timing of when you would do that strategy and how complementary is, let's say, swimming or horse riding or music therapy or behavioral therapy with other programs that you're doing. And under this, I want to throw out a couple of questions for the listeners if you're thinking about choosing programs, or if you have already chosen some, you might want to go back to those service providers or the people at school and ask some W questions. So I'm just going to throw them out to you. One, if you're online or you're, again, talking with someone at a school or service provider, you might ask them, what is this specifically for? And Chantal, I throw this out because you know, I surf on the net around autism. I read, I go to conferences, as I say, and I'm often wary when someone is saying that this product can really help with everything. It can help with eye contact. It can help your child to focus. It can help your child to have conversations and throw a ball better. And so I'm really interested to know, well, how about really specifically this particular diet or this particular substance or this particular program? What is it getting at? So that's one. What is it specifically doing? Who does it work best for? Are there kids that it doesn't really work with? Are there kids that it definitely does specifically work for? And is my child one of those? The next one is, which symptoms does this really specifically address, and which doesn't it? Which doesn't it address? So how can this helps a parent to set expectations of what they could really gain from implementing this strategy and to not be disappointed when it's not a cure-all. Another W question would be, when? When talking to someone who's asking me to do a hyperbaric chamber therapy, for example, I might say, hey, when should I do this? Can I do that any time, at any age, at any stage in a program? Recently, I was informed by a hyperbaric chamber person I was talking to that they recommend that you don't do hyperbaric until after you've done some other biomedical treatments, which I didn't know that they would recommend that, and that, you know, started to be interesting to me that this person would actually turn some parents away and say, your child's not quite ready. I appreciate that idea rather than just saying, sure, we can do it anytime, any place. Okay. And I'm going to just share one more principle, and then maybe we could open up questions. And that would be the way that I design programs, and I really have tried lots and lots of different ways over the years. This is sort of 20 years of work and putting things together, trying different ways. I want to stress that multi-treatment does not necessarily mean all at once.
Right.
So I'm sure there's many, many listeners and many parents listening that are thinking, hey, I've had my child enrolled in sort of 7 different programs and we're already overwhelmed. How many more can I squeeze into a day or a week? And actually, one of the things that I do with parents that I work with is often review the programming that's happening already. And sometimes we eliminate some things. We take some things out. It's not just about fitting more and more things in. And we would do that to, again, try and really think about which ones of these are working together. Are there any things that are kind of canceling each other out a little bit? How is it working for the child? Is the child overwhelmed sometimes? And would we want to pull one of these treatments out and wait 3 months to put it back into the larger picture a little bit later on? Is there a timing or sequencing consideration we might want to have? So multi-treatment, again, isn't doing as much as you can all at once, but that there would be an order and a timing consideration to what you're doing. So I just wanted to throw those out as kind of a basis of maybe our conversation tonight.
Those are really helpful points, because I think part of the reason why we need all these questioning is that there is not two kids with autism who look alike. And so what works with one child may not work with another, and that makes it very difficult for parents. And so those kind of questions that you mentioned they should be thinking about and asking is very important for parents to take and listen to seriously, because that's the only way you're going to be able to make some sense of all the information that is out there.
I agree. And I think, unfortunately, in our field currently, all of us professionals and service providers are not talking to each other enough to make these decisions easy for parents and to just give that information readily. We should be able to say to a parent, hey, you know what, this actually isn't the right treatment for you, or it's not the right time, or I think you should try this first before that. And if we could just all get together in a big room somehow, all of the different therapies, which each one has something really good to offer, but we could kind of decide where we all fit on the bigger treatment map, that would be such a gift to parents.
It certainly would be. So I'm going to start with one question. Simple. I mean, I hope it's simple. It's from Norris in San Juan, Puerto Rico. What is the difference between floor time and RDI? Do you know
Great
the answer
question.
To that one?
Well, I can throw out a couple of ideas. I'm not an RDI specialist, nor am I a floor time specialist, but I've sat in on presentations of both programs. I've read books on both programs. So I could throw out an idea in any case.
Okay.
Both of those programs would fit, in my opinion, under a sort of a play-based model and certainly a relationship socialization model. So those programs would be programs that I would think of using, whether you go full on in one or the other or use pieces of both, which is what I do in putting a program together. You'd use those to address social development and social communication, sort of language, conversation skills, and so on and so forth, and also the play, imagination, and things like that. The Dr. Greenspan's model, the floor time, he's a developmental psychologist, and so that program is really pretty strongly based on a developmental model, meaning that there are certain stages that a neurotypical child would go through, and so Dr. Greenspan would propose that it'd be important for your child to also go through those steps in a certain order. And I'll give you a little example. Some children would go from sitting to directly to standing and walking, and they might miss or skip over the cross-crawl phase where a child would crawl across a room. The belief in floor time is that that would maybe mean that your child's brain development didn't get the benefit of cross-crawl. So in the floor time program, then we'd go back and we'd do some exercises where that child who didn't cross-crawl could have opportunities to do some cross-crawling. Whereas in RDI, by Dr. Goodstein, it's not sort of focused exclusively on developmental order, but he might sort of look at the child's strengths, the child's challenges, and again, in particular, in terms of relationship specifically, and the goals and objectives would be ordered and listed according to how we could best help this child in terms of relationship and communication. But both of them are play-based, interaction-based, and I think both of them have some great value.
And here's another question that sort of leads out from that very nicely, from Tiffany Phillips from Humble. Is it possible to combine floor time with some ABA principles and RDI? I know floor time and ABA are opposite, but is it possible, and would this be very beneficial?
The answer to Tiffany is yes, yes, and yes. here I am, obviously tonight, really advocating that you do mix programs together. By the way, let me say it again: not for the sake of simply mixing things together, because I think that's a cool model, but because all children have a variety of needs. I have never met a child who only needs to have their behavior changed, without learning how to also play, for example, and relate and do that kind of stuff in terms of social communication. So, but let me zero in on something that I think she's asking, which is an important thing. When you're going to combine a play-based model or play therapy and socialization with an IBI, maybe LOVOS model, for example, I think it's really critical, and I've seen the best success when you have those two groups of therapists or those two different program directors talking to each other. So the question, maybe I'm going to reframe it differently, isn't can they be combined or should they be? I think, again, the answer is yes, yes. The real question is how can you combine them? How do you combine them? And it seems to me that unfortunately the monkey in the middle often is the child who kind of gets tugged and pulled one way or the other with different learning strategies and different expectations between the programs. So, for example, in an IBI, I'm using that because that's a Canadian term, the
right.
Behavioral intervention. That's our Canadian term for behavioral and ABA program. In those programs, for example, compliance or sitting at a table and doing table work and following instructions is fairly highly regarded and high up the list of what were sort of our expectations of studentship on the child. Whereas, in contrast, let's say in a floor time model, we're really trying to encourage the child to take the lead at times, to initiate, to use his imagination, to go outside of the box of routine and rote learning. So on the one hand, the child for half of the day might be asked to not stand up and not be creative and only do what was asked of him. And 2 hours later, he's being really encouraged to step outside of the box and not be so self-restricting. So you need to get those two groups of therapists talking to each other and figure out how we can make the child's experience, don't look at the objectives necessarily and what the therapist thinks, but how can we make Billy or Jimmy or Jack's experience more cohesive throughout the day?
I think it's important for all the types of therapies that are involved. For example, if you have an occupational therapist involved and a speech therapist and whatever program it is that's going on at school, if everyone's not sort of coordinating together or meeting every once in a while or sharing notes, it's kind of not as effective for the child as if there were a team approach where people are, as you say, sharing information and making sure they all understand what the goals are, what the big picture is.
That's right, yeah. A team approach is really good. And happily, that's really happening more and more, both in Canada and the States, that school boards are recognizing team approach is important. Many different organizations are. I'll throw out one just little other tidbit for Tiffany that
okay.
sort of applies to the rest of the conversation. In the IMTI program, that's the program that I run, my personal choice and what I've seen work best is that we start with play therapy and then we move to a behavioral program. And we actually do one before the other. And I'll just tell you just very quickly why. It seems the literature supports this, the research supports this, and that is that the social development, the social communication, and the play, if that comes first, then the kind of studentship skills like cooperating, following instructions, paying attention, having better eye contact, those seem to be in place, and I'm going to say spontaneously because they've developed and they're there, so that then when it comes time to structured learning and adult-led learning, almost more of an IBI approach, we don't have to use so many external reinforcers, you know, and strict policy, if you will, in learning, but I find that the children are much more willing to come to the table and enjoy learning and actually be curious about learning. So it's much less of a struggle. If there's any parents listening who really, you know, have found some benefit in an ABA approach, but their children kind of really still struggle with the process in terms of resisting it and don't seem to have a lot of joy, I'd recommend you might even pause a behavioral program just temporarily and really just do some play, some enjoyment, and then go back to the behavioral one.
Yeah, it's true that if there needs to be some enjoyment somewhere along the way.
Yes.
Okay. So many questions here. I'm trying to figure out which one would be the best ones to ask you right after that one. But here's one. It's kind of a open one, but maybe you have some suggestions. This is from Marley. My son is 6 and still doesn't speak. Speech therapy seems useless. What should I do?
Wow. I would want to know a bit more information. I know that's not possible, right in this context, but I'm going to throw out some, just a couple questions. Again, one of the principles we talked about was consider physical health first, and I would throw that out in terms of speech development as well.
Right.
I'll give you a quick example. It seems like there's a high number of children who have been diagnosed with autism who have also had chronic ear infections. Many kids I've worked with have tubes in their ears, and many kids may still suffer from ear infections. In that case, it's possible that the child has intermittent hearing. It's possible that there's certain sounds that they're sensitive to, and so on and so forth. This is just one example. I'm certainly not suggesting this is the case for all autistic children,
right.
But it's just an example of how a health concern could be related to slow or delayed language development. So I would say, first of all, Are there, and I mean we need to go beyond having hearing tested. Many parents say, oh, I've had my child's hearing tested. He seems to be hearing fine. That might be true, but there may be other issues with language development, like vision. Hearing is one of them, and so on and so forth. So that's a pretty detailed conversation. That'd be the first thing. Second thing I'd suggest to you is that speech therapy often is done on a pretty low-frequency basis. At least in Canada, a child may have 8 weeks of speech therapy, you know, twice a week for an hour. And I'm going to suggest that that's not enough for language development. So a couple of options are make sure that your speech and language therapist is teaching you, the parent, the techniques and what they want you to do, and that you do them at home as much as possible in the home environment, in real-life situations. So if you're being told to stay outside, if you're not being included in what the strategies are, be an advocate, get in there and figure it out, or switch therapists and work with someone who's really going to include you as the parent. That'd be the second thing. The third suggestion I would make is to make language, and this might sound a bit counterintuitive, but make talking and language a game rather than an exercise that is serious and focused and controlling. And what I mean by that is we can get into situations where we're trying to almost tug that word out of our child, as opposed to just being playful with words, with language, and delighting in them. So as the mom is pouring juice the next day, she's maybe singing the orange song and saying orange, orange, orange over and over, but in a playful way. Orange, orange, orange. So she's starting to make language something that he might want to tune into and associate to. The next day he might want her to sing that orange, orange song again, and he might indicate that by tugging on her, making a sound. And so we start to get him even engaged and interested in language.
Yes. May I make a couple suggestions?
Absolutely. Please.
I would think also to check on how the motor development is of the child, because some of them may have may be hypotonic, which means that their muscles aren't that strong, and maybe the speech therapy is not helping in terms of that child's not coming home speaking, but they're working on the muscles. That's another thing. And also, I see this happening frequently in the United States, that a child is nonverbal at six and still has no alternative means of communication. And a
right.
lot of times this happens because people are afraid that if they give them an alternative means of communication, they'll never learn to speak.
Oral. That's right.
And I have to say that research clearly shows that if you give them an alternative means of communication, it only helps to build the speech if there's going to be speech. I have never seen, well, maybe you can tell me if you've seen anything other than that, but it seems to me the research that I have read shows that if you do have an alternative form of communication, it will help speech. It won't keep speech from happening.
I think those are two excellent points, Chantal. And in the program that I run, we usually try and we attempt for oral communication first. And we don't drag, that's not a protracted experience. I mean, we might try that
right.
for 3 or 4 months. And if
right.
we see that the child's attempting, we'll continue with that. But then if it's really not happening, using other forms of communication, PECs, whatever it is, can often open up really big doors for the child, lowers frustration, starts to teach them about symbols and connecting to communication. Really, really good point. The only thing that I usually talk about, again, is let's try oral first and then
right.
go for the next one. Great point.
Now, the other thing, too, is that behavior is a form of communication. And if they do get to the point where they're very frustrated, you might start seeing all these types of inappropriate behaviors. And then we're focusing on these inappropriate behaviors instead of perhaps teaching them a way to communicate, which would have stopped a lot of those inappropriate behaviors in many of the children.
Yep, and once again, you're addressing the idea that we really need to look at the child as a bigger person with lots of different facets happening. You can't kind of just isolate out oral language
and
after trying it say, oh, what can I do? You know, you really look at the bigger picture.
Now, here's another question from Yuko Worm in Visalia, California. My son was diagnosed with classic autism at the age of 2.5. He is now 4 years old. With various treatments and therapies, he is better in a lot of areas, but certain things that have not changed and even seem to have gotten worse are his visual stemming and his sensory disorganization. I have no idea what we can do to at least lessen his visual stemming. He is obsessed with air conditioning units, ceiling fans, grates, and something that flaps and makes movements. Any advice would be appreciated.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, there's a lot of different thoughts on this. Some people would just say you really need to stop your son from self-stimulating using a stim. I'm not one of those people, so I'll just say that up front. So I'd be really curious to investigate what's going on for him and why does he have these attractions, if we could possibly solve that. So again, I'm going to go to biomedical first, and I'm just going to throw out a couple of ideas. First of all, there's a researcher named Mary Megson, who has been part of the DAN movement at different times, and her research has focused primarily on, or at least this part that I'm referring to the vision is, on beta-carotene, so vitamin A and cod liver oil, and she's published some very interesting academic and research papers looking at groups of people with autism who have hand flapping or peripheral vision challenges, so again, with the vision, and why that might occur and how you might help that. So you might want to, first of all, look up Mary Megson's research. The second thing I'd throw out is biomedical, but not a supplement, but more physiological and how the eye is shaped and so on and so forth. There's a wonderful doctor I believe he's in New York and Long Island. His name is Dr. Kaplan, and he specializes in vision. He promotes a certain therapy where children will wear different lenses. It's not the color lens therapy. That's a different therapy. But this is actually lenses that are designed to help the eyes learn how to work together, depth perception, and so on and so forth. And for some children, it's very, very helpful therapy. So you may want to look up Dr. Kaplan. That would be another idea. Then I'd move from the biomedical side and go to the social side. And I've worked with many, many children who have different repetitious behaviors, different sort of interests like lining up objects or like reading certain books over and over. Might be a verbalism, a verbal stim. In this case, if your son has a visual stimulation, I might want to explore that socially with him. So I'd start doing a functional behavioral analysis, looking at, are there patterns of when he tends to look at the fans and the grates in your house? For example, is it around meal times? Is he trying to avoid sitting at the table together? Is it when he's really challenged and asked to do something? Is it when he's left on his own and he's not directed? So I'd sort of see if there's patterns and times when he engages in these behaviors, and that might give us some clues as to how we might begin to help him socially to choose different kinds of behaviors and different kinds of stimulation rather than those activities. There's more ideas I have, but those are a couple to begin with.
Yeah, those are good ideas. Two listeners have sent in comments about the child who's six and still doesn't speak, so I'm going to read those because they might be helpful. Liz from Rutherford says, my son didn't speak till we cleared the yeast overgrowth from his gut. And then Jill from Amityville on Long Island says, the caller with the non-talker at six, this was how my son was, and he did not have hearing loss, and he had PT, physical therapy. He did have hearing loss and had physical therapy, but he went to an audiologist for 3 years and did get tubes, and then with speech therapy began to talk. It took years, but now you would never know that he couldn't talk, although you can tell that he has some speech delays. I agree with all that you have said, but my son also used the PECS picture system, and yes, it did help his speech. It did not alter it. It gave him confidence. So
right.
That's good.
So I agree. And well done for being that advocate and piecing it together.
Right. And I would say that you were talking about vision therapy, and that seems to be helpful with many children, and I would also, I know that you talked about one person in particular. It is important to try and find the right therapists for working with different types of therapies that we're talking about. So, I mean, I'm sure there's other people besides Dr. Kaplan, but it's good to know that that just made me think about how it is important. For example, when I was choosing different therapists for my son, I would look on the internet, but I would talk to other parents who had used different therapists, and I would also talk to other professionals who had sent children to different therapists, and you kind of then sort of conclude, get an idea of where to get started, because sometimes I find that it's hard to decide who to go and see, because there are so many options.
Right, and for those of you who were able to write down some of the questions I propose that you ask service providers and people who are selling products, if you ask some of those questions and they can't give you an answer as to who it best works for or who it doesn't or when you should do it, then you might want to find someone else. So learning how to ask questions and definitely asking other parents as well.
Okay, and I did want to ask you, because I neglected to do it at the beginning of the program, but could you please now give your website address, and also can you tell me if those questions are listed on your website?
Well, the website address is www.imti.ca. So that's the short form, the acronym for Intensive Multi-Treatment Intervention. IMTI.ca here in Canada. The four things that are the questions that I listed and the principles are not written up there, but if it would be helpful for your listeners, I'd be happy to write that up, Chantal, and I could send it to you, and perhaps you could post it on the webinar site. Would that be useful?
That would be useful.
Sure.
That'd be great. Okay. Thank you so much. And again, at the end of the program, I'll ask you to repeat your website once again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We have quite a few questions that have to do with biomedical interventions, so I'm going to ask a few of those. Annette in San Diego is asking, what is your take on the methyl B12 shots? Have they been known to help in any kind of way? Thank you for your time.
Okay, great. And I think it's the important disclaimer here is I'm not a medical doctor, and so I'm obliged and don't give medical advice. But if you're asking for a personal opinion, I would really just say that there's been some really good research on the methylcobalamin, the B12 shots, and comparing also shots to creams, dermal creams, and also to the nasal spray. I work with several doctors in Ontario here. One of them is a proponent of the needles, and one of them is a proponent of the nasal spray. They're both sort of among the two top that you'd want to go with. I can tell you that I've seen behavioral changes in children who have been on the B12 shots. Now, here's the disclaimer, and this is the important part, I think, of the multi-treatment approach, and that is that the methylcobalamin fits in to sort of a treatment protocol that the DAN doctors have listed and worked out. So what you don't want to do is just rush out because you heard that, you know, someone, another child or a parent in a chat group said, yes, it's been really helpful for me, but you want to work with a medical doctor who's familiar with using methylcobalamin in a larger protocol. You want to do it at the right time, in the right place in the treatment.
Right. Now, have you been trained as a DAN doctor, or have you attended DAN trainings?
No and yes to your question. So
I'm not a medical physician.
So I haven't been trained as one. I have attended four DAN conferences over the years, starting way, way back. The last one I attended was in San Diego, out there on the West Coast.
In my town.
That's right. And before that was in Washington and one in New Jersey. So I have attended quite a few. And in San Diego, I was invited to attend the Physician's Day. It's a physician's training. So I did sit in on that and listen. Yeah.
Okay. here. There are a couple of questions here that are really for medical physicians that I do not feel comfortable asking you. But let's see. There are so many here.
I think I saw one. I'm not sure, Chantal, if this is okay, but I saw one on the list that was asking, what do I think of the CFGF diet?
Oh, yes, I was getting to that one. Go right ahead.
Oh, okay. Could I just throw something out about that?
Oh, go right ahead.
Great. Sort of personal opinions aside, I just wanted to say this fits really nicely in our discussion about what to do and when. The casein and gluten-free diet is a diet that's designed specifically to eliminate the proteins in wheat and milk, right, the casein and the gluten. Mm-hmm. So with the families that I work with, and again, in conjunction with a doctor, and we can do some tests like a peptide test, for example, that tells us whether a child needs to have those eliminated. So I think the idea is not to just jump into something. This would be my opinion, but to determine whether your child needs it or not. Now, some professionals will say, hey, listen, it won't hurt your child necessarily to try that, so why don't you just try for a couple of months and see. But where we get into a bit of a challenge with that approach is, first of all, there's quite a bit of report saying that you need to do it for at least sort of close to a year to get some results. So it's hard to try just for a couple of months and determine changes, although many parents have reported changes in a short time. And I think we also have to consider when we're eliminating foods and restricting a child's diet, we have to make sure that they're getting the full range of nutrition possible. But I've definitely worked with parents who have had very good results with that diet, and there are other diets like the specific carbohydrate diet, for example, which are appropriate for other children with other kinds of needs, like a yeast infection, for example. The CFGF diet would not address a yeast issue per se.
It's interesting that you should say that about the CFGF diet, about how long it needs to be tried out for, because I get different responses on that too, because I also have had practitioners tell me, oh, just try it for a couple of months and
right.
You'll know.
Right.
But I think that maybe the difference is that, because I've also had people say you have to be on it for 8 months. I think the difference is that within the first couple of months, you might see some changes in your child, which shows that it might be beneficial to continue, but you don't really get rid of it in your system for 8 months. I'm still not really sure about it. And so I wonder, like somebody like me who wrote 3 books can't figure it out. It must be really hard. You know, I have access to people to ask, but I get different answers from different professionals myself.
Right, and I'm with you 100%. And the conclusion that I draw from that, because I'm also, not a professional on the CFGF diet, but have had exposure to it through hundreds and hundreds of parents, the conclusion I draw is that the group of children and adults that we're attempting to help and work with is not a homogenous group. In other words, they're not all the same. They don't all have the same symptoms or the same challenges. There's such a wide, wide range. So if you almost imagine that we could take the whole population of people with autism and they could each fit into different subgroups, and some kids will really respond to this diet and some kids won't, and some kids respond early and some kids will respond to it later and some kids not at all. And so again, the question for a parent is, so how do I know if this is right for my child and how long? And those are the questions you need to be asking of, you know, books that you're reading and other parents and doctors that you're working with, is get into figuring out, is this for my specific child, even though the child down the road, it really helped him.
Right. Okay, here's a question from Krista in Syracuse, and I know that part of this you may not be able to answer because you're not a medical physician, but I think there's parts of it that you can shed some light on. My son is now a teenager with Asperger's. We have been unsuccessful with medications until a few years ago. They sadly misdiagnosed him with bipolar ADHD for years, and they would never recognize the autism syndrome I was seeing. Is that common to mistake high-functioning autism for these? Why do doctors do that? Then she mentioned some medications that her son is on, and she asked about the med combo. I don't think that's a question we can address here. But do you have anything to say, because she has more questions, but do you have any comment to make about the mistaken diagnosis?
Well, sure I do, yes. And from my experience, I can only answer that, yes, it is common that higher functioning, especially sort of teenagers or children, people that have been, that are older, let's say, they're not 4 and 5 years old, but 11, 12, 17, 18, can have multiple diagnoses. And that comes about in part because parents are often continuing to search for answers. So you may visit more than one doctor. A parent who has a child who's 4 years old has maybe seen one or two physicians. If your child is 17 or 18, you may have been to 6 or 7 different centers and 8 different specialists, and so you're getting different answers in part. And they may be addressing actually different parts of the spectrum of challenges your child has. Even though they're high functioning, there's still a range. The challenges can go in different domains, from social to language to behavioral. So there's that piece. I would throw out again in terms of sort of why do they do that, or why does that happen? One answer might be that the symptoms for autism are really quite broad, and so are other diagnoses as well, like bipolar or like depression, or like manic or like OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Some of those disorders, each of those are also quite broad reaching, and so there are overlaps in terms of the symptoms that
right.
we have. And so that's a common thing.
We also need to remember that Asperger's syndrome was actually not considered as part of the diagnostic model until the mid-90s.
Correct.
And so many professionals were not that knowledgeable about it and recognizing it.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that's really good about so many cases of autism now, is that you hear so much about it that most professionals have a better understanding, and now they will typically look for Asperger's sooner and not just misdiagnose as something else. But it's very, in my travels, in my conferences, and just meeting people, there are so many people out there in their 20s and 30s who were misdiagnosed as bipolar, schizophrenic, and only as adults are realizing they actually have Asperger's. And for them, it's a comfort because now they know where to go for strategies.
That's right. There's a historical factor there. And might I just throw out where the mother who asked the questions, in some ways feeling a bit frustrated with the system, there's definitely a group of people with Asperger's on the internet, in chat groups, talking and representing themselves for the autistic community, who in some ways are promoting the idea that autism and Asperger's can be what they say in the medical field, comorbid with other challenges, meaning that you could have Asperger's and also have depression just like anyone else in the world.
Right.
And whereas in the past we might just lump the symptoms for a person with Asperger's all into just Asperger's, and as a result we might look at it primarily behaviorally, and the person might not really get help for a depression that they might have. Now we can say, hey, we can treat depression, and that might be really helpful for that person. So it may actually be beneficial sometimes to parse those pieces out, to separate them out.
So I'm going to continue with her questions or her comments. He is functioning for the first time, conversing, smiling, and trying to make relationships, but he still gets zoned out in his own world and does some odd things. We also have him in counseling biweekly and an inclusion classroom setting at school. He wants to work, and I'm trying to apply so he can have a job coach. But what can I expect to see at this stage as he is a teenager with Asperger's?
I guess the question would be with regard to what, because it's just a really...
Well, she was talking about his meds at one point, what is the right type of medication combo, but that's really something that needs to be seen with the medical doctor. But I guess it also means for now he's starting to... function for the first time now that he has these meds, and he's conversing and smiling and trying to make relationships. But how does she move him forward from that, or what she should be expecting to see as more improvements?
Right. Yeah.
What can you hope for someone with Asperger's?
Well, when I talk to parents about sort of future possibilities and hope, I really encourage them to continue to have lots of hope, that this sort of the age barrier that I think, again, historically was set up at about age 5, sort of this magic line that if you don't get language and you don't get socialization by age 5, there's not as much hope. That's really being faded away and dissolved as we learn more and more about the brain and its plasticity and our ability to change and grow over a lifespan. And certainly a person with Asperger's is not kind of preset and formed by the time they're a teenager. There's lots of development, lots of growth. Chantal, you could probably speak to that as well.
Right.
You've written extensively about this idea of development for a higher functioning a teenager. What I would say from my perspective, though, is when a child or a young adult is of that age, our focus does really become on independent self-help skills, getting a job, and so on and so forth. And in this particular case where language or attempt at language and interaction is just starting to blossom and bubble, I would say to not overlook play therapy type of approach. It's going to need to be upgraded at a level that's mature and fits in. But when I say play, that can include recreation. It can include going for bike rides, learning how to play billiards. In other words, having fun and not making life and interaction and therapy all about having to, really grow up and be an adult. So I think there's a balance there.
Yeah. There's a lot of things I mentioned in my book, Adolescence on the Autism Spectrum. But I would also suggest to this parent that now that she knows he has Asperger's, to look at what's out there. And there's a really good book for helping with success at school on the emotional level, organizational level, because that's an area where many have difficulties with, and also with the social area. And that's called Asperger's Syndrome in Adolescence, Practical Solutions for School Success. And that's by Brenda Smith. Miles, M-Y-L-E-S.
Great, good recommendation. He may also benefit from, if he can get online and surf a little bit, he may benefit from becoming involved in some of the chat groups that are out there of other people.
Right, I would suggest GRASP, G-R-A-S-P. GRASP is a very good nonprofit organization which does advocacy and self-advocacy for people on the autism spectrum. 50% of the people on the board are on the spectrum. I would also suggest that one area which could be very helpful is cognitive behavior therapy. So in other words, besides learning what's right and wrong, is really learning how to make those decisions about what's right and wrong, how to figure out to taking responsibility for your actions and for what's happening next. So,
yep.
But that book that I mentioned by Brenda Smith Miles, and also I'm not trying to push my book, but really it is a general book on adolescence and autism, and there aren't that many out there that may be able to help this mother.
I think that's great. I'm working. I just want to throw out, just to squeeze in, I really want to stress that a person also needs to have fun interactions with people. That,
right.
That if you're a teenager with Asperger's is interacting with lots of therapists trying to get his stuff together with him, and he doesn't have really fun social experiences, that's not great either. So it's sort of have a balance.
Okay, well, I have a funny story about that because my son Jeremy is 20 and he doesn't have Asperger's. He has a little bit of verbal, but he communicates by typing, okay?
Right.
And he's been really on the topic of wanting a girlfriend and wanting more friends. And so he goes to see a therapist every other week now because it's like, I know he needs a girlfriend, but can't just go out to the store and get one. And he really has to develop his relationship skills, but I feel at his age 20, it's not mom that's going to be out there with him all the time. And so this therapist is working with him, and everyone that's around Jeremy is working on the fact that he has to develop more communication skills, take more initiative, and also to practice relationship skills. And so the therapist brought up the idea of finding different places for him to go to practice or to meet people. So we're thinking of volunteer groups like Clean Up the Beach and this and that. And she brings up church, and we haven't been going to church for some time. And, you know, she brought that up amongst other things. And Jeremy opted for church. And, you know, I thought I was going to get to go out, hang out in some bars or pubs to help myself with social skills. And now I have to go to church.
Good. Well, and
okay,
it's important, as you know, to follow his lead on this one.
Exactly. And I guess it'll be good for my soul, too, huh?
That's right.
Okay, here is a question from Diana Alvarado in Madera, California. Should a parent continue to heal their child naturally versus the expensive biomedical way if they see high improvements in their child, even though many doctors still do not believe in naturally healing of the guts? Example, oil of oregano kills yeast and bacteria. Cilantro chelates mercury without side effects. Licorice root extract helps with anxiety and stress. Nani juice or acai juice are very high in antioxidants and are a great perk for the immune system. Any comments?
Wow, it sounds like a list that some people could follow. In the program that I run with families, we do both working with a medical doctor, following primarily the DAN protocol, but there may be other things out besides that that a medical doctor might address, and also what's considered complementary or alternative medicines. I think you sort of answered your own question when you said, should a parent consider switching or changing if they're seeing really, really good results? Well, I think if you're getting great results, you should probably stick with that. Having said that, there may be some pieces that the complementary alternative medicines are not able to address. Methylcobalamin would be an example of one that you can't get in a health food store and you do need to do under medical supervision. And it seems to be an important piece of the puzzle for some children. So, again, I don't think that the medical community has at its fingertips everything that that may be required, but neither does complementary medicine. With those other things that she had listed in the email there, I do strongly recommend that parents don't sort of take those kinds of protocols under their own direction. In other words, work with someone who has had training in nutrition or naturotherapy, like a naturopathic doctor or homeopathist, people who have been trained and hopefully have certifications or state, state certified, because even though it might be just oil of oregano, you want to make sure you're getting the right doses and things like that. So again, I think it's important to work with a professional on that.
That sounds very smart. Okay. Here's Kristen Anderson from Upton, Massachusetts. My 12-year-old son has PDD-NOS. There's a lot of questions in here, so let's see if there are some of them we can answer. His working memory and processing speed are very low on neuropsych tests and, of course, affect what he does at school. Are there any treatments to support both of these? Do many ASD and learning disabled children have difficulty laying down myelin? What is the research saying? Also, my son was recently tested for mercury levels and was found to have overly high levels. I'm going to stop there because it continues some more, but do you have anything to say about what she's said so far?
Sort of surfacey. She's referring to important research where they're looking at brain development, the myelin sheath, and that's in some circles related to diet in terms of certain kinds of oils and fats that you're absorbing and may or may not be processing in your body. In other cases, some geneticists believe that you may be predisposed to not being able to lay down that myelin sheath, or it's a bit thinner or thicker. And in a behavioral sense, the behaviorists and the behavioral physiologists would believe that your myelin sheath can grow. There's been quite a good research on this based on input. In other words, if I do a puzzle 10 times or I do a puzzle 25 times, the neural circuitry and pathway that's making that happen is going to get thicker in terms of its circumference as I do it more. So yes, you can lay down myelin sheath by input. So that's sort of what I would say. In terms of measuring it in your body and in the brain, it's obviously very difficult. I don't work on that end so much. I'm a treatment specialist. So I sort of say, what are your child's challenges? What are his strengths? And how can we go forward and make new pathways, if you will, moving forward?
Right.
Are there other questions there?
Yes, there are.
Yeah.
She says, okay, so her son has recently tested for mercury levels and was found to have overly high levels. The PCP practices integrative medicine and is preparing my son for chelation. Will chelation help increase processing speed or working memory? His doctor suspects that his mercury levels are due high to the ridiculous number of shots containing thimerosal given to him as an infant. He was born in 97. Have there been any new updates on a more reasonable vaccination schedule for children?
Sounds like a question. This mom should go to a DAN conference.
Right.
But, I think
do you have any? Do you just have an answer at all about the chelation helping? Do you know anything about that? About helping processing speed or working memory?
Sure. Yeah. Not from a scientific basis, but anecdotally, I've worked with about half a dozen children in the last 2 or 3 years who have all had chelation. IV chelation, actually, and I've seen cognitive functioning both in memory and also in language skills improve quite a bit. The problem is it was not a scientific study, so the children were also having other therapies, so it's hard to say whether it was just the chelation, but that was something we added, and we saw some pretty nice improvement there. I would just say I hope that this person is. It sounds like she's working with a doctor, but chelation, and if you do it, you know, there's certain precursors that have to be done. You have to take some tests in the body, make sure the body's strong enough and ready. Check out the liver and so on and so forth. But hopefully the doctor's taking care of that.
Okay, here's Sheila Flattery from Jacksonville. Can an adult or teenager still benefit from ABA therapy, music therapy, auditory integration therapy? How beneficial is vision therapy and auditory therapies? Are these research studies or evidence-based studies supporting these therapies? And what about hyperbaric chamber? Are there studies on that as well?
Wow, excellent questions and lots of them. That's exciting. First of all, yes, adults can respond very well to different kinds of therapies and treatments. And let me just add, I think, first of all, when you're working with an adult, and especially if they're a slightly higher functioning adult, it's really important that they're participatory in that. You know, with a 3 or 4 year old, it's easier in some ways to kind of do the therapy on the child, or, you know, they don't have as much choice in it necessarily. But if someone has some of their independence and they're making some of the choices, make sure you include them in that decision process so they don't feel it's happening to them but with them. I want to say that right off the bat. The other thing I'd say is I've worked with two families in the past year with older adult people with autism in their family, and really a lot of the work to be done was with the caregivers around, let's say, surrounding and supporting that person, and beginning first of all with helping that community of caregivers, including parents and friends and caregivers, to really check into their own beliefs and their own sort of vision of this person. So I'd make sure that the people helping this adult believe that change is possible, so that their own behaviors and their own cheering and acknowledgement and the actions they might take is really supporting the change. So I just want to say that up front. In terms of those particular ones you mentioned hyperbaric, you mentioned music and auditory training,
auditory
and visual. Each of those, again, can be helpful for sure. In terms of a multi-treatment approach, I'm gonna recommend that each of those are addressing specific different challenges, and you want to make sure that the person that you're thinking of using them with needs those. So I wouldn't just try them because you might have heard that they worked or that there's some research for them. You want to make sure that they are appropriate for this particular individual's challenges and needs. And how you should assess that is reading the literature as you're doing and talking with those service providers and the people doing that. Would this fit for my child or for my my brother or sister, the adult that you're working with? Really make sure that it is suitable for them.
Yeah, and I would have to say, because my son is 20, and there are a lot of things because of his age and because of when therapies were developed that we didn't get to try till he was older. And again, I only tried the things that made sense for him. But I always thought that my son was visually processing well because he was always staring at things, and it wasn't until many, many years later I realized that he was using it for stimming.
Right.
And we tried the auditory integration therapy with him when he was 5 because he wasn't responding. And after just 2 or 3 days of the therapy, he started responding to sounds. And I'm not saying this is going to happen to all the kids, but it's about how you can analyze what can help or not. And now that Jeremy can write, he tells me why he did what he did and what was helpful and why.
Right.
And so it's really interesting, and he's actually put it all down, and I think that he has to publish it somewhere just so parents can, because I think that's the hardest thing is when you're a parent of a nonverbal child, because it's really hard, even if you are observant, to read a child and figure out whether they're getting something or not, or how they're using their vision. And in fact, Jeremy just started vision therapy over the last year, and we really thought that he couldn't read. We knew that he could read or at least see letters to a certain extent because he could pick things out and he could type. But we didn't know if he could read like a page. And so now we've just tried certain things with him, and we realize now that if we put the pages open in front of him and we don't read it to him and then we ask him questions, and these are pages, stories that I haven't read or the support person has not read, and he can answer questions, and when we look, they're the correct answers. And so,
Chantel, you're bringing up something that's really, really important for this person to hear. A, that it's possible for change to occur in a teenager and adult. And the second thing that I want to throw out that your story illustrates really nicely is that the treatment map, or the map that you're kind of following and trying to figure out, evolves. And it evolves as each new sort of strength and then challenge unfolds and becomes apparent. And sometimes that doesn't happen until you clear up one issue. Just a really quick example, a boy that I was working with, 7 years old last year, very, very hyperactive, wouldn't sit still. So one of the first issues we worked on was that hyperactivity, and we addressed it through both biomedical as well as a playroom therapy, play therapy approach to begin with. Once we got into that third phase in the IMTI program where we get into some structured learning and we sat down and started reading, similar to your story with your son, Chantel, we realized it was very apparent that he had dyslexia. He was starting to write letters in reverse. He was reading things in reverse. But we didn't know that. That wasn't apparent when he wasn't able to sit down and focus. So once he was sitting down and we had cleared up some biomedical issues and he was more focused, then, oh, wow, hey, look, there's this other piece here now that we can start to address. So to the person who wrote in, you know, what do you think of this, and this, I would also recommend maybe choosing one of them to begin with, seeing what happens with that, and then seeing what sort of, you know, what that clears up and what issues are unfolded after that.
Okay, here's a question from Swati in New Delhi. Can you please elaborate on VBA, which is verbal
behavior,
I guess, correct, in context of high-functioning children with autism or PDD, NOS? I guess, what does that look like, and how could it be useful? Do you have any
pretty broad question. I want to sort of ask questions about, well, again, whether it's a child or an adult, what sort of challenges are there? What are you wanting to achieve with that particular person? Definitely, for example, Vince Carbone is a well-known sort of verbal behavioral approach, and there are others out there, and can be very, very useful. My particular feeling on language acquisition, language development, is that it's got to be fun, and it has to be functional, but also can be silly and playful as well. So if language is taught in a very, very pedantic, dry, not so fun, but kind of, you know, in the gym, training, working hard away, it may not flower and blossom to its potential. That's my experience. So if you go for a verbal behavioral approach, definitely there's pluses and strengths in terms of really identifying stages and steps and very clear goals and really measurable units, which is excellent and very good at creating conditionalities and setting up behavioral systems so that the child's motivated. But really find a therapist and a methodology, someone who's actually doing it, who's very personable and can relate really well to the child you're thinking of. I like to embed verbal behavior therapy and different kinds of language approaches within play strategies, within going out strategies. For example, you could go out and do some outdoor recreation and still be working on language. So it doesn't have to be restricted to sitting at a table across from each other just working on words. Although, again, for some children, isolating movement and isolating other distractions can sometimes be very, very helpful to just focused on mouth movement and producing language. So you really need to do an assessment on that particular individual and see, is this therapy right for them?
Great. Here's a really good question. I think many people have the same kind of problem. This is Michelle Wolfson in Carlsbad. Do you have any suggestions for a child who learns very quickly with ABA, that's Applied Behavior Analysis, but has trouble generalizing?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. Generalizing, first of all, when we think about generalizing, and I'm sure this mom is already aware of this, includes generalizing to different across environments and also across people, and I would suggest also across sort of a range of people, meaning different ages, to peers and adults, and then ultimately to different situations that are related but not exactly the same. So you're able to generalize out to different situations. So that's the first thing, is just to kind of recognize that it's not just to do it in the den and then also at the kitchen table, but we want to go much broader than that. That's the first thing. In terms of how to actually do it, I would say in the first instance, to make the trials of the ABA more varied, which is kind of opposite to how ABA is often applied. So you're talking about a bit of a reconstruction of the ABA model. And I'll tell you, in the IMTI program, we have a thing called a TILS. It's an acronym for a certain kind of trial, a therapist-initiated learning segment. But it's like a behavioral trial, except a couple of things that I don't do is I don't prescribe the instructions. So where, and I'm saying this is an important feature of trying to generalize, whereas in a really strict ABA program, each therapist is sort of scripted to give the same verbal instruction, I allow the therapist that I work with to say different words, maybe phrase it the instruction in a different way, but they're getting to the same point. And I have to say, I haven't worked with a child with autism yet who can't function under those conditions. In other words, I don't believe that a child with autism needs to have the exact same sort of instruction given, otherwise they won't be able to do it. So that's just one example of shifting things up a little bit, maybe where the therapist sits, the voice tone that they use. Those are examples of how you could begin to generalize pretty quickly.
Yeah, I would make one suggestion that kind of makes it easy for a parent to remember this rule, or even a teacher, is how I have found generalization to be the most useful in different people that I know, is to start with changing only one thing at a time, especially if he's doing really well at ABA, but he's having a hard time generalizing. So, for example, if you're changing the tone of the voice, you don't change the different kinds of stimuli that you're using in front of him. So you change one thing at a time until you can change two at a time. So if it is a different person doing the work with the child, you keep the same kind of tone of voice and the same stimuli until they're used to that, and then you change it. Do you see what I mean? Changing one thing at a time and then making it more and more difficult. Because sometimes that's where kids fall back. If people say, oh, someone's doing really well at ABA, and then fully expect them to all of a sudden generalize to everything at once, that sometimes is what creates the problem. But changing one thing at a time, which is what you were suggesting, but I just kind of said it in one sentence so it kind of people remember in their mind, like, change one thing at a time to begin with.
Right.
So
let me throw
totally
something.
Confused.
It's a very good point you're making. Let me throw just a slightly different model as well that
okay.
you could do in addition to what Chantal is suggesting and what I had suggested. And that is from, this is right out of developmental psychology and educational psychology research. And that is that when you watch a neurotypical child, how kids typically kind of generalize principles in their lives, whether it's behavioral or social, they do it through their curiosity and exploration. A good
Correct.
Example of this is a baby that's crawling around and picking different things up and dropping it or rolling it or spilling things. And they're exploring the properties of the world, essentially. And they do this socially, too. They giggle and smile and reach out to their mommy's nose. And then they might try the same thing with their daddy. And then they might try the same thing with Uncle Bill. And they may get different responses. And they're learning about generalizing and the different reactions they can get. In an IBI program or an ABA program, if there's not time, let's say, for, I'm going to call it sort of more free play, free exploration, where there's not rules, there's not guidelines, there's not ways that you have to do something, but you can just sort of have more creation and imagination and play, that generalization may be a little bit slower. So that's why I was saying I like to mix and blend programs together.
Right.
So we might sit down at the table. We might practice the hello script. Hi, my name's Jonathan, and what's your name? And we might practice that a little bit in a really focused trial way. And then I might play a game 10 minutes later where it's free play, and we might use puppets. And with those puppets, we may rehearse that script. But I allow now for much more variation. I don't expect the child to have to stick to that script. But if he goes off on just saying, hello, 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 then I might respond accordingly. And so that now I feel he's playing around with and testing and pushing the boundaries around that to see, well, what happens if I say hello, 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 hello? In a trial, I'd have to correct the child. In play, I can play with it and we can build.
Which is
right.
Great. That's great. Okay. This is from Lavada Robertson in Roanoke, Virginia. How many families do you know that have benefited from the combination of ABA, speech, OT, PT, and biomedical interventions? We have had huge success with our daughter, but had to stop due to the costs of all of it.
Right. My answer is, in terms of the IMTI program, 100% success of families, because all of the families I work with are combining each of those that you mentioned and oftentimes others. So that's the first thing. Having said that, I have worked with families who may only do two of those or only three of those. And again, it really depends on the child's needs, and you need to look at that. But I'd say most children with autism can really benefit from the ones that were listed in there. In terms of, the cost, absolutely. Depending on what state you're in, depending on what country as well, since I'm speaking to you from Canada, different resources are available to you. And it really does seem like it's a huge burden on families to have to pull all of this kind of stuff together. I want to just throw out an idea for families listening who are thinking, yes, that's right, it is a burden, and how do we manage it? It's something I mentioned very early in our discussion this evening, and that is I mentioned something about a speech-to-language pathologist, and as a parent, making sure that you're included in that therapy in some way, that you can listen in or watch, or maybe it's a video recorded and you can see it later. Make sure that you have a consultation with that speech and language therapist so that you can go home and implement it. And what I'm talking about is not to add an extra burden that the parent then has to become the therapist, because you need time, downtime too. but you are with your child a lot of the time, whether it's taxing them back and forth or whether it's putting them to bed or bath time or dinner time. And if you can use some of these strategies and you can do one or two of the exercises in the home, you may find that, A, the treatment effect really speeds up, because there's consistency across environments and the child's being exposed to more of it across individuals. And you may also find that you can teach other therapists to do it too. So, for example, you might be talking to your behavior therapist and say, hey, you know what? This speech and language therapist told me this thing. I wonder if you could be doing that. So now all of a sudden you have four people all really helping him, you know, do the tongue thrust to get the T clearer instead of just that once an hour in the week. So you almost become a conduit for generalizing that to different therapists in a way.
And these questions are kind of general, but I want to ask them because they're from Marwa in Cairo, and I really try and help the people out in those countries that really do not have very much of anything to guide them. What about homeschooling, i.e. the parents' role in treatment? That's her first question. And the second one, what about hyperbaric oxygen therapy to an autistic infant who's 2 years old?
Ooh, you know, I'd like to address the first one, and I'm going to leave the second one just because it really does get into to a medical issue, even though hyperbaric therapy is seen as a complementary issue. Turns out that hyperbaric chambers are used throughout North America in a variety of ways in hospitals. But in any case, because you're talking about an infant especially, I think you really need to talk with a doctor, and I'm not going to give
right.
an opinion on that one. In terms of home-based programming, I'm a big fan of home-based programming with a big but or a however, and it comes back to the discussion we're just talking about, resources. I think it's so important, Chantal. I know that in your writings and also in your experience as a mom that you would agree with this. It's so important that the mom and the dad and if they're siblings, that it's manageable what you are taking on. Again, there's so many treatments, there's so many professionals saying, try this and do that, that moms and dads too get burnt out or they get stressed out or overwhelmed. And when that happens, then there's more tension in the house, maybe a shorter fuse, less patience, and it doesn't feel good for the child. It certainly doesn't create a healing environment. So if you're going to run a home-based program, make sure that it's designed in a way that's sustainable for mom and dad and the siblings. Make sure it's not going to be a huge, huge strain on your finances, on the other kids in the house, and so on and so forth, because otherwise that environment's not going to be healing. Some of the bonuses and the pluses, since you're asking, to a home-based program is obviously, first of all, control. Moms are often, you know, we've all heard of the doctor moms who kind of have to learn a lot. Moms often play that role of, again, advocate, of learning, of facilitating and coordinating a lot of the programming. So if it's in your home, you're doing it already outside. When you bring it into your home, you're that much more in control often. You can bring in experts, and I would recommend that you don't isolate yourself in the home and pick one model. I think this is a problem with home programming, is people may pick, let's say, just one type of play therapy approach or just one kind of ABA or behavioral approach. And since I'm advocating sort of mixing in a multi-treatment model, when you're in your home environment, there's a tendency to kind of be somewhat isolated and working within one system. So really keep open to other people giving you input and bringing it in. So those would be
some. I don't know what this. Those are good good comments. And I don't know what this person's what this parent's situation is in Cairo. I just know from myself, having lived overseas with Jeremy, that at one point I had to run a home program, and it wasn't because. I mean, I really had to. I was in a situation where there was nothing for my son. And
mm-hmm.
so the positive aspect of that was that, in fact, I did get to learn about how my son learns, and I got to do a lot of generalizing with him because I knew how he was learning, so I was able to use it in different environments.
Right.
But, you know, it was a lot of work, and also I have to say that earlier, when I lived in the United States, I used to work with adolescents with autism, and I, in Lovas, was consulting to the hospital I was working
to
at.
It.
So I had some experience.
Right.
Now, you know, of course, I had none of the, I didn't have the wealth of knowledge that I now have, but still, I did have something to start with, and I do appreciate everything that Jonathan has said about the stress and making sure that you're taking on something that you can. But on the other hand, if you're living in a country or in a place where you really feel that you have no options, the positive aspect is that you will feel some fulfillment from seeing growth in your child learning. But I would like to also say that just make sure that you do only what you can do, because if you do put yourself up to trying to fulfill certain quotas of like, I have to do 40 hours of ABA myself, or, you know, I have to find people and I can't afford to pay them, you know, some is better than none.
Definitely do that.
A little bit well instead of a lot, but not well and stressed out.
Yeah. So one of the exercises I do with a family who's asking that question is kind of like a resource inventory. Let's list, you know, what are your financial resources? What are your time resources? Do you work full time or part time? Are you at home? What are your family support resources? Who's around to support you? What are your professional resources? And kind of listing those. This is for the person in Cairo. This might be a nice exercise for you to do. Kind of writing those down and taking a bit of an inventory and sitting back and saying, do I have the resources around me that I could feel comfortable and doable to do that? I'm just going to throw one other little thing in terms of there may be some parents listening or even professionals thinking, but what about socialization? Because this is one of the counter arguments
That's
to
true.
Home-based programming. And so I'm kind of going to ask a question that some of you might be thinking. In the IMTI program, again, we sort of do it in phases to try and accommodate both of those perspectives. So we start, almost all of the programs that I run begin in the home because it's a highly control of an environment we can control, and we can determine who's coming in, who's going out, and what the setup is. But as the child develops and becomes more social, perhaps develops some language and acquires some behavioral skills, then we start to integrate peers and playdates, and then ultimately transition to a school environment. So there's that sort of phasic approach, if you will. So what I wanted to throw out is for those people who have read that socializing is, you know, obviously a core deficit in autism, and the way to do that is to go and be placed with lots of other children or young adults. I would just suggest that the research really shows that a child can benefit from socialization and peer groups and play once they have a couple of behaviors in place, like when eye contact is a little bit better, if they have the ability to imitate, if they have some language or some reciprocal play ability, then they can really benefit much more from being around other children. But if you're talking about a child who's severely autistic or who really is very limited in their social skills, no imitation, very low eye contact, close to no language, then I would recommend that a more intensive one-on-one adult-led, whether it's home or in a center program, is probably going to be best to begin with. So sort of some things to consider.
Mm-hmm. Okay, here's a comment from someone who's writing in. Mikey from Westbury, New York. Overall, I agree with the multi-treatment intervention process. I presently work with various aged, developmentally delayed children who are diagnosed PDD, NOS, autistic. Some of these children that I see are using different strategies to aid in reaching their full potential, not just ABA techniques. The children who have this well-rounded educational program seem to better generalize things that was learned one-on-one. I also believe that there should be a strong school and home collaboration. It has been key to helping reach my students' IEP goals and generalize things well within school and home.
I agree with him 100%. There was a great report put out years ago in the States that it was a huge study. It's a longitudinal study. It's been going on. It continues to go on. But what I read, their latest release, it was about 20 years into it. And they were following children with special needs and their families. And one of the interesting data that came out of it was that the children whose parents had been rated as the most involved with school, they were the sort of the strongest advocates and going in and asking the teachers for information and really making sure they're involved, their children were the ones who were most likely to A, get a job placement, and B, have success in the job. And it was just a very interesting sort of fact that you might not otherwise think about. So there seems to be a strong correlation between parent involvement in the school and future predictive of future success. And my only sort of caution to that, while the research found that, is there's many moms and parents who are simply not in a position to do that. Single parents, low-income parents, parents who may have more than one child with special needs in the house, and so on and so forth. So I think along with that research, we can take that under advisement, but then our role as professionals is to really figure out how can we make those connections happen between home and school or home and other therapists. And when I was doing work, I just want to throw this out, when I was doing work at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, I worked on a program that was called FINE. There's an internet site, F-I-N-E, and it was looking at the research on this issue. And one of the big conclusions they came to is that schools and teachers and guidance counselors and special ed teachers really need to be the ones reaching out and empowering the parents, inviting them, maybe making phone calls home or doing whatever they can to really strongly encourage parents to get involved and finding ways that they can get the information they need so that there can be a collaboration back at home.
Very good. I'm going to ask you a question here because a couple people have asked questions on this topic, which is one of my favorite topics, though I wish it weren't now that my son is 20, but unfortunately I still have lots to learn on this topic. This is from Lavada Robertson in Virginia. How do you recommend parents and caregivers approach toileting with severely autistic children? And this parent is asking because she says there are many methods and we aren't sure about how to approach this with our 4-year-old. So it's for a 4-year-old who's severely autistic.
Right. And the last thing that was mentioned, there's many methods. That's one of the challenges. Again, how do you decide? Well, I can throw out my method, if you will. So I don't know if that's helpful to give you yet another one to decide between. But here's some issues to think about. The first thing, again, I'm going to go back to is I want to consider biomedical first. And certainly with many children with autism, we know that autism seems to be correlated, or at least many children in the population do have kind of gut issues, whether it's constipation or inflammation of the gut, bloating, that kind of thing. So if this 4-year-old little guy is having some constipation or diarrhea or bloating or gas, I would try and resolve those issues and heal them up through a biomedical intervention even before I begin toilet training. And the reason why is because if the child on the one hand is having any pain passing a stool or internally, it's not likely that you're going to get cooperation or consistency on the toileting. And so I try and, you know, not get into a tug of war and put a lot of effort into the actual behavior of toileting until I'd resolve that. So that is where I would begin. If I felt that I'd resolved that issue and my child is fairly regular and doesn't seem to be having pain with passing a stool or urinating or going to the washroom, the next thing I want to do is I want to make the toilet and the washroom area a place where, and these are the two important things, where the child has control. So it's not an area where when the child goes, you know, he's forced to sit on the toilet or he's forced to go through a certain routine. So I want to make sure he has control, that it's a user-friendly environment. And secondly, that it's a place that's associated with toileting. And I say that might sound funny for us adults who associate going to the washroom with a toilet, but I'll give you an example. I was working just this last weekend, actually on Sunday, with a family, and we were doing this exact talk, and I asked them, where do you change your child's diaper? And the father said, well, pretty well wherever he is when I need to change him. And that could be in the living room or up in the bedroom. We also have a diaper change table. And some of the therapists are changing the child in the playroom where he's being worked in. And I said, okay. So he doesn't associate necessarily the washroom or the toilet
That's
with
a good point.
Toileting.
Good point.
Yeah. So I said, from now on, whenever you know he has, you need to change his diaper, unless, you know, it's super messy and you just have to do it right then and there, and sometimes you do, but 99% of the time, you can scoop him up or walk with him or herd him over to the toilet, and then just do the diaper changing process from now on right beside the toilet. And so to facilitate that, you may need to have a mat, like a yoga mat, for example, or a workout mat that you can just roll out and have there. I'd say to have all of your wet wipes, your toilet paper, and anything you need, the creams if you have them, all in a bathroom. And if you have a couple of different bathrooms, that's okay. Try and have a stock of those things in each of the bathrooms in your house so you can get to one and do what you need to do in the bathroom. That's step one. You go there and just keep doing that. Now, as you do it, I'm going to say a couple of other things because this is an important issue for lots of people. So I'm going to say a couple of things. The second thing is how you respond and react and talk to and have facial affect about what's happening. So I'm talking about attitude towards the washroom. And I'm saying this because I've observed many, many parents, almost in jest and fun sometimes, do things like they're changing a diaper and the child's laying there and we might go, "Woo, that's a poopy diaper. Oh, that's a stinky one," or, you know, "Oh, yucky, yucky, poo-poo," and we kind of move it over there. And we're sort of just communicating with our child and interacting. But I think the message the child may get, even though we're being a bit playful, is, "Oh, this isn't something that mommy and daddy are really happy about, and it's something that they're getting rid of really fast and something they don't want me to, you know, kind of touch or be aware of so much." And so I may be closing down lines of communication. In other words, I want to teach even a child who's 4, and I know that they said that he's very autistic, but I want to let him know that if he needs to go poop or pee and has a feeling, that he can come to me. So the presentation I'd be doing is I'm there, the child's on the floor, I'm taking off his diaper, I'm starting to change it, and I'm looking at him, even if he's not looking back at me, but he's there, he's hopefully listening, and my voice is calm and maybe even a bit enthusiastic, and I might say something like, "Hey, you did a poop. That's a good boy. Pooping is good for you because pooping is good for him. It's good that he's eliminating in that way." So I want to give him the message that I'm excited that he did a poop. I'm happy that we're here together, and I'm going to help him. And by doing that, what I find in my work is that children more and more often have little signals more frequently, whether it's they're just touching their diaper or they move towards the door to go to the bathroom, or they may even start taking their parent over there, which is obviously a huge step. So your attitude is really important. Okay, next, just a couple of steps. So you're changing the diaper. What I do next with the child laying there is I actually empty the contents into the toilet. That's one of the reasons why you're right there.
Oh, now, very good.
You're making an association, a visual behavioral association, that this is where this stuff goes. Now, if it's a stool that can, a bowel movement that can be going in, just let it go right in the toilet. If it's just a pee diaper, that's okay. You can just kind of pretend. You just sort of hold it up, shake it a little bit. So, again, you're making the association. This is where it goes into the toilet. Now, there's another bonus to that, and that is once you've wiped your child, you know, pulled up his pants and he's there, then you get the flush. And some children will flush. Some children are excited to do it. And now you have some contents in that he's actually really truly flushing, including some of the toilet paper that you may put into the toilet, which is a step. A lot of parents use wet wipes, which is, you know, fine, but I encourage them to use some toilet paper first, even if it's just once or twice, so that the child can see you taking the toilet paper off of the roll, wiping his mom, and then putting it into the toilet, and then he's going to flush that. Then you use the wet wipes to clean up, but at least he's getting those steps. So flushing, even for a child who's very autistic, may be something that he'd want to do and try. Again, I wouldn't force him. I wouldn't, you know, take his hand over hand and force him, because then he's not having control in this situation. When we're talking about eating issues, when we're talking about toileting issues, it's really, really important that what you're doing is empowering the child to take control of his own body, because he's the only one in the end that can do a poop on the toilet. You can't force that. So you're trying to encourage him to take control rather than forcing him through a routine that might be uncomfortable for him. So we do the flush, and we do a celebration, and hopefully with that routine, we start moving towards it. There's a lot more to it than that, but those are some of the places that you could begin with.
Okay, and I was just going to add one more thing to when you talked about at the beginning, you know, seeing if there were issues with diarrhea or constipation or gassing. I would also suggest that if you have a child who has autism and who has a lot of hypotonia, that means that the muscles are very soft.
Mm-hmm.
That child, if the muscles, you know, for walking, for crawling, for moving around are not working where they should be for someone developing normally at that age, it's going to be the same thing with the muscles that have to do with the bladder and retention of the poop. And so you'd want to make sure that, you know, you're working with a physical therapist for the whole body, but that child might not be ready physically in the sense of his muscle tone.
That's
to
right.
Deal with using the bathroom.
That's right. And you're talking about actually sort of control of his body. I would go
the
even a step.
Muscles, yeah.
Yeah, and I would add even holding himself up on the toilet and sitting and being in that
right.
position.
Exactly.
One of the accessories that we add to all bathrooms that I'm doing toilet training in is a footstool so that when the child's sitting
right.
on the toilet, whether you lift him up or he's sitting on his own, that his feet are flat instead of dangling. And when
that's
your feet are flat and supported, then you're able to relax your bladder and your leg muscles and your sphincter so that you're able to actually go to the washroom. Whereas if any of you are listening and you have a young child that he's willing to sit on the toilet and he's there and that's not a problem, but he just doesn't seem to ever go on the toilet, if he's having to hold himself, so if his hands are on the side of the toilet seat and he's kind of holding himself there and his legs are dangling, it's possible. It's possible that he's not relaxed enough to go. That's right. So putting a stool there, and in one particular family, we even installed an arm rail just so that the child could hold on there and, again, kind of relax onto the seat a little bit,
right.
And presto, it happened for that particular child. I'm going to add one other thing, and you might read this in a lot of books on toileting. They talk about timing. And some books advocate taking the child frequently, like once an hour, so he can try it. I am not a fan of that, and I'll tell you, it's because you get more blanks or false negatives than you do positives, because there's no person on the planet that has to go to the washroom once an hour. But our bodies do work. Again, if your child's body is functioning typically in terms of their physical body, the gut and the pooping cycle, the bowel movement, typically a body will want to have a bowel movement and urinate after, you know, half an hour to 45 minutes, let's say, for a little child, maybe even sooner than that, after eating and drinking. So you give the child its favorite juice or water so that the bladder starts to get full, count about 20 minutes, and then offer the washroom. And you may want to sit there for 2 or 3 minutes if the child isn't going right away. So you the child's more likely to go if he has a full bladder, obviously. So timing, you can think about, important.
But I have an interesting piece of information about that. Which was a real surprise to me. I probably might have mentioned it here on another webinar if it came up in a question, but I'm going to mention this because I think you might have something to say about this. But, you know, in my latest book, Autism Life Skills, what I did is I interviewed all kinds of adults on the spectrum, from those, you know, on the more able end to the less able end of the spectrum. And I was really surprised to find out that many, even on the more able end of the spectrum, have a hard time feeling their body in overwhelm situations. And I found this out because I was interviewing someone in the lobby of a hotel who had Asperger's, and you know, her cell phone rang, and she said, "Just a moment, please," and she left, and she came back. And I thought, okay, so, you know, I just said to her, everything's okay at home? You know, I assumed she had a phone call, and she said, "Oh, no, when I'm out in public, I cannot feel my body if I'm in situations of overwhelm with light and sound, and I can't tell when I have to use the bathroom, so I set the alarm to remind myself to go every 2 hours because I can't feel if I have to go."
Right.
And then I started asking people, and quite a few people had the same issue. And then others said they couldn't tell the difference between if their stomach was full or they had to use the toilet.
Yeah.
And these are people, and so, you know, that's why I understand what you're saying about not taking them and making them go at a certain time, but for some, it might be helpful if they're in situations like that.
Right. Well, let me
situation.
Yeah, let
maybe
me.
You have a suggestion on how to help with that.
Well, let me clarify, though. I was actually advocating taking your child at a specific time. That's why I was suggesting.
Oh.
But I was saying not according to the clock, you know, 9 o'clock,
oh, okay.
11, 12, but more according to eating and feeding cycles.
Okay.
So,
all right, so what you're
so
saying
you're,
is after that time, specific time after having eaten.
Right, because
okay.
your chances that the person does have to go are much greater.
Correct.
Than if it's on the hour, every hour. So actually, the woman who you interviewed, I don't know if she does this, she said she sets her cell phone so it rings and reminds her. Maybe she would set it for about an hour after she
right.
eats the three meals a day. And,
right.
and that might really work for her body. So something like that makes sense. You raise an issue that a lot of parents can, your examples, a lot of parents could identify. If you have a child who typically seems to hold his bowel movement or stool until they come home. A lot of parents say this, and one of my theories on that is that they're just kind of overwhelmed and dealing with school and trying to manage and focus and things, and when they come home or in the car on the way home, if they're wearing diapers, that's a sort of the kind of moment where, you know, I'm in more of a comfortable situation, a familiar routine,
right.
I'm going home, I'm not being asked anything right now to do, so then I can let it happen. So for those parents, it may really be helpful to, as soon as you come home, you know, try the toilet and encourage that. By the way, some children who do have sensory issues, as Chantal, you were mentioning with some of those adults, you may want to modify your bathroom a little bit. I've worked with a couple of parents where putting a rug down in the bathroom, even though it's not the most sanitary thing to have a sort of a larger big rug necessarily, but for a while, because if your child, for example, has auditory challenges or seems to cover his ears, and some of the parents recognize this, that bathrooms are super echoey. Most modern bathrooms have a lot of tile and glass and mirror and chrome, and they could be really echoey, and you add to that a toilet flush. So if I'm working with a child who covers his ears to vacuums or blenders or seems to, you know, talk very softly and that kind of stuff, we're actually going to modify the bathroom to make it less echoey, and we won't do the flush routine, and I'll actually show the child that they're, in quotes, safe and can trust that they'll be able to go to the washroom and that they could call mommy or daddy to flush it, you know, after. And if they know that
good.
They can trust that, then they can go. And so there's an example of sound. I do the same thing in terms of heat. Some people with autism have reported that they're very sensitive to sort of hot and cold. Well, bathroom tile floors can be very cold for a child, and the toilet seat can be very cold. So we've, again, had success with keeping the bathroom, you know, warmed up and heated, and the child's more willing to go. So those are just some examples.
Interesting. Now,
mm-hmm.
I've had quite a few questions come on, so I'm not going to read them all, but they all have to do with the same question, which is, you know, these are people all different parts of the country and Canada, and they're asking, how do you find therapists or people in their area to help them, whether they're therapists, DAN doctors? Do you have a suggestion for how is the best way for people to find the best people to help them in their area?
Well, I do, Shanta. You mentioned it earlier, and you're a parent in this situation, so you'd agree with this. It seems like parents who have either been through it ahead of you or who are going through it, they often are beating the path in some way ahead of you. And I think it's really valuable to not recreate the wheel and not have to do a research every time that you know, a child is diagnosed. And this is really one of the reasons why I created the practice that I have, is to try and mm-hmm. save parents hundreds of hours of finding all this stuff. So what I'm getting at is, if you're a parent of a newly diagnosed child or recently, and you're sort of just trying to figure out what do I do and where do I go, getting into chat groups with other parents, hooking up, going to a local support group, and oftentimes you'll come away from a meeting with three or four names of, you know, oh, this is a great speech and language path, you definitely should work with this doctor. And I think you should still check them out and research and interview that
Definitely.
person yourself and maybe even check with other parents and say, hey, have you heard of Dr. Johnson? Because I was recommended, and get a second opinion. But I think, first of all, that's a great place. In terms of, you mentioned Dan Doctor quickly, there is a list on the
web. Autism Research Institute.
It's that's right.
Autism Research Institute. If you Google Autism Research Institute, I know the homepage looks a little busy, but you can find that there's
Dan
a list of Dan practitioners, and not just in the United States and in Canada, but in any country where there exists one. So for listeners that are listening from overseas, that's good information to know. I would also suggest TACA, Talk About Curing Autism, TACA, now. And because they have a mentor program, they have a website, and on the website you can also find out about their chat online, which is a good way. I know at the beginning when I moved here, I got on there, would ask questions about different therapists, and again, you get different advice and different opinions and different names, but then you can ask people certain questions and you can continue looking on your way. But Autism Research Institute and TACA, T-A-C-A. Also, if you have a local Autism Society of America chapter, you know, some chapters are different than others, but you always find parents there, and you can find parents to give you information. And it does take a little time, but that's how you manage to find the right people.
Yeah, and can I add, since today's topic
is
around multi-treatment, I rarely hear that parents have a challenge finding a therapist for a particular thing, but more finding a therapist that's open to merging other treatments specifically doing something that the parent wants. So I'm going to say again, really take some time to interview that professional. Don't jump in, you know, the day you meet them. Ask them some questions, and some of the key questions, again, I just want to repeat two of them. One is ask them if they're open to working with other professionals, with other people that you already have on your team or you're thinking of adding to your team. If you're talking to a behavior therapist, say, hey, what do you think of play therapy, and would you be willing to work in conjunction with a play therapist too, if that's what you're thinking? So I wouldn't get engaged in a contract with someone who is not willing to talk or work with or discuss other approaches and incorporate that, first of all. And the second thing is that you as a parent feel that they're personable to you, because you're your child's advocate. You need to be able to ask questions. And if you're working with a therapist who's either dismissive to parents, or they say, oh, well, you know, you can just stand outside or whatever it is, then it's not the person to be working for. Work with a parent-friendly therapist, definitely.
Great. Now, here's a question from Jen in Ontario. How many hours does your typical IMTI program require? Can you describe what a setting and session for a verbal high-functioning 5-year-old child with ASD would look like, and what is the average cost for a program?
Oh, good questions. Right down to the nitty-gritty.
That's it, because, you know, we're down to the last 8 minutes, so I'm getting down to the nitty-gritty, too.
Okay, perfect. I'll keep this succinct, too. Hours, the number of hours of actual therapy is completely determined on the child's needs. So you're asking an average. I'll give you a range instead of an average, because I work with a really real cross-section of children. I ran a program 2 years ago with a family, and we topped out at one point at 65 hours. Now, I'm giving you an extreme range. And that wasn't all in a playroom one-on-one. That included family time, that included outdoor recreation stuff. But we literally had a programming going on that much time, and he responded terrifically to it. On the other end, I'm working with a family right now that where the child has 1 hour a day. A child's in school full-time and doing well, but there's some other issues. And just 1 hour a day we have programming, and then also 2 hours on Saturday and 2 hours on Sunday. So there's a range. range and really everything in between in terms of hours. What would a session look like for the child she's describing? Again, depends on what we're trying to address in that session. She mentioned high functioning and the age, but I would want to figure out, do we want to focus on kind of play and social skills, or are we looking at working on some more kind of academic stuff, like how to do homework independently, or are we really drilling down into a specific academic area like reading or writing? Or is it more sort of independent skills like learning to do a zipper? So the session will look different depending on the child's needs. I'm going to just throw out one last thing about the session because she kind of wanted a picture. Environment. Do we do that in a special playroom I've mentioned this evening or out in a park? That would depend on how much the child seems to be distracted environments and overwhelmed. So for some children, sitting in a classroom with lots of noise and sounds and other kids seems to be overwhelming and distracting, and they're quite fidgety and have a hard time focusing. So a quieter environment might work. For a child who doesn't seem to be distracted by it, then I want to work in the most natural setting possible. In terms of cost, she can get a hold of me. We can talk. I'm happy to give the cost, but I have a consultation fee per hour that I work with families on, and there is a sliding scale. So families who have lower incomes or may not be able to afford it, I want to find a way to accommodate them, of course. And then if a family decides to work with me on a biweekly basis where I see a family every other week, some families I see once a week, and I direct and design a program, then there's obviously a package fee, which is reduced from an hourly rate because we're engaging in an ongoing contract to work together. So she should go to INTI.ca and fill out on the contact page and just simply send me an email and contact me, and I'd absolutely have a conversation with her.
Michelle in Carlsbad wanted to know if there are other professionals doing the kind of work you do, and or do you train people to do what you're doing as well?
There are professionals who work on a multidisciplinary team approach. I don't know I can certainly say in Canada, and I haven't met in the States. Chantal mentioned, I worked and trained in the States for almost 10 years. I'm not aware of someone that's merging in the ways that I'm doing and paying attention to sort of order and timing. So I'm not able to give you a name of someone that's doing that. There's certainly professionals in the Toronto and Ontario area who are, I'm going to say, IMTI friendly, people that I work in conjunction with and who are really open to, as I said, dialoguing and talking and working with clients together. So I'm not able I just don't know of other people doing this kind of approach right now. In terms of training, absolutely, I would be happy to work with other professionals and train and also learn from them. I continually learn, and this is one of the aspects of the IMTA program, that it's a sort of fluid, open method that evolves and grows as research comes available, and I'm always open to changing my ideas and growing and learning as we learn more.
This has been Jonathan Alderson, who has developed the Intensive Multi-Treatment Intervention Program, IMTI. You can read more about him on his website, www.imti.ca. This has been MomsFightingAutism.com. I've been your moderator, Chantal Cecile Kira. And thank you so much, Jonathan, for your time and for all the information. So people can reach you again on imti.ca. That CA stands for Canada. That's why it's not .com.
That's right. Thank you, Chantal, for inviting me, and thank you for all the excellent questions. And please do feel free, anyone who wants to send questions and continue this conversation over the Internet.
Thank you, Jonathan. And to everyone, be the change that you want to see. Thank you.